You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been in his octopus's garden in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see. In an octopus's garden in the shade. We would be warm below the storm in our little hideaway beneath the waves, resting our head on the seabed in an octopus's garden near a cave. Octopus's garden in the shade. We would shout and swim about the coral that lies beneath the waves. Oh, what joy for every girl and boy, knowing they're happy and they're safe. We would be so happy, you and me, no one there to tell us what to do. I'd like to be in an octopus's garden with you. In an octopus's garden with you.
And welcome to the Stone Tapes. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
In the studio today is Davey J. Howe.
Evening.
The lovely George Mann.
Hello.
And, of course, our producer.
Am I not lovely, then?
Oh, you're lovely, but I'm married to you, so I'd be a bit biased saying that, wouldn't I?
Just checking. All right.
And, of course, our producer, Alex Lefchuk.
He's waving.
And he's not allowed on the microphone again today. He's been banned. And, of course, joining us today on the telephone is Patricia H. Ash. Hello, Patricia.
Hello.
Hi. How are you? How's sunny Texas?
Pretty good.
Fantastic.
Texas is lovely.
Are you proper hottie?
Not really, actually.
I thought I broke you then, Patricia.
No.
Oh, well, it's lovely to speak to you, Patricia. And we're going to go straight over to your little corner and find out what you're reviewing today.
Right. Well, I'm reviewing a book called Hounded by Kevin Hearn. I think that's how I pronounce his name. He's included a pronunciation guide for all of the Gaelic in his book, but not for his name. So I'm a Kevin Hearn. Is that how it's spelled? Yeah. Anyway, so it's an urban fantasy book set in Arizona, which is unusual for urban fantasy. Usually those things are in, like, New York or something. So that was interesting because you have a whole different environment there. So there's a 2,000-year-old druid, and he lives in Arizona because he's hiding from somebody who is a god who wants his legendary sword. So he's been hiding this legendary sword for the past 2,000 years, and he's currently got an occult bookstore/tea room.
All the best occult books always have a tea room.
Oh, yeah, I'm sort of feeling Buffy now. You were saying...
I was saying...
Yeah, a little bit.
I was saying Thor. It's a bit like, you know, Thor and Loki open up tea rooms opposite each other in Lincoln High Street or something, you know, and have a battle over who's got the best tea cakes.
I'd read that.
I'd read that too.
Anyway.
I'd definitely read that. Anyway. So he's living in Arizona, and of course the person who is after him finds him, and that's the whole plot of the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a bit more to it than that, but I don't want to spoil anything.
So what age group is it aimed at, this book?
Oh, it's adults. It's definitely adults.
Oh, well, that says it all, doesn't it?
Shenanigans in the tea room.
Definitely adults. Right. And I think it's a bit of wish fulfillment on the part of the author, because not only is this druid extremely powerful, but he beds at least one goddess in every book so far.
Oh, wow.
Read two of them, but two different goddesses.
Well, someone's
got to
do it, I suppose, you know.
Yeah, it's a dirty job, but someone has to do it.
Someone's
got to
do it.
Yeah, yeah.
So what would you rate it, Patricia?
I would rate it 7 out of 10, mostly for the snappy dialogue and the entertaining narration, and also the talking wolfhound. This druid has a talking dog, and he is the best dog.
That sounds amazing, actually. Well,
Is that why it's called Hounded?
Hounded.
No, well, no. But it should have been the reader.
I'd be a bit too clever there.
Yeah,
okay.
Maybe.
Never mind. So what's the author called again?
Kevin Hearn.
Kevin Hearn, as in the hunter. Hearn the Hunter.
H-E-A-R-N-E.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As in Hearn the Hunter. Excellent.
Yeah. Sounds good. Sounds good.
Excellent.
And now over to George.
Oh, I'm a bit scared now.
Yes, in this month.
With echo, month.
40 years ago this year.
Oh, wow, yeah.
The year of my birth, so obviously a choice year.
Yes.
A very famous radio show made its debut. Its first episode was broadcast on the BBC, on BBC Radio 4. Any guesses?
Mm. Patricia?
Any guesses, Patricia?
No idea.
Can we get a clue?
A little clue. It's a radio show that's just made a return.
Ooh.
Just in the last couple of weeks, there's been a new series of this same show.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to think what I was doing 40 years ago. of course, I wasn't born then.
Shall I give you another clue?
Go on.
Don't panic.
Oh,
yeah, I think.
Well, it's got to be then, hasn't it? It's got to be
Douglas
Adams.
Yeah, Douglas Adams. Very famous.
No way!
Fantastic.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, 40 years. I started it with about episode 3, which I happened to catch on Radio 4 in my bedroom one night. And then I think they repeated it fairly shortly after they did the first transmission.
I only came through the books. I've never heard the radio show.
I only ever saw the BBC series.
Oh, right.
Wow.
Which I absolutely loved.
Oh, the radio show is sublime.
And
I'll
say it's back with based on that Owen Colfer book.
Yes.
So
that's correct. Wow.
Have you seen any of this, Patricia? Have you seen the remake film?
Yeah, I've seen the BBC series.
Yeah.
And I've seen the film that they did where Alan Rickman was the robot, and I've read the book, of course.
Yeah.
I think you ought to
But I haven't heard the radio show.
No, I haven't heard the radio show. Yeah. It's one of those I think I'd like to listen to.
I'll have to indoctrinate you. When I find my tapes, I'll have to listen to it. Anyway.
So yes, next up, does anyone like stargazing here?
Ooh. Oh, a little bit.
A little bit stargazing.
Yeah.
60 years ago, so on the 19th of March, 1958... Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, opened the London Planetarium, which was the very first planetarium in Britain.
60
years ago.
Years ago. Yeah. God, that makes me feel very, very old. 60 years ago, wow.
1958.
Okay, I've never actually been to the planetarium. I've been to Madame Tussauds, which is kind of next door.
Yeah, likewise.
But I've never actually been to the planetarium. Yeah.
But I do have a telescope, and I do like a bit of watching the moon every now and then.
Watching the moon. Lovely.
Are you one of those people that can spot which planetary alignments, or what do you call it? I mean, I don't know.
Constellations.
Constellations, that's right.
I know one or two.
Which
the
lights?
Plough and Orion. And
which lights the planets?
That's the only one I know.
The ones that my kids also know.
Yes.
I'm going to go further back in time to 100 years ago now.
100.
Now, if anyone remembers, what's the film? It's gone out of my head now. Hugh Jackman and the stage shows and the magicians.
Oh.
Based on the Christopher Priest.
Prestige.
The Prestige. That's
Prestige.
The one.
Yes. The Prestige.
There's a scene in there where one of the magicians tries to catch a bullet.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yep.
Well, obviously, you'd like to assume that that's actually all an act.
A trick. Yes.
A trick. But 100 years ago, on the 23rd of March 1918, a very famous magician, William E. Robinson, who worked under the stage name Chung Ling Su, died during an attempt to catch a bullet in London.
Oh, wow.
And he actually got shot and it perforated his lung.
Wow.
He died the following morning.
Oh, no.
So he actually tried to catch a bullet by the sound of it. or something went wrong with the trick
didn't
anyway.
Didn't anybody tell him you really can't do that?
Now, Sam and I saw live on stage Penn and Teller do their catching two bullets.
Still don't know how they did it.
And we've no idea how they did it.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Absolutely just mind-blowing.
They never had any contact with each other at all. And there was somebody
opposite sides of the stage, bit of glass
between them.
Someone from the audience bringing things. Incredible. Incredible.
Crazy stuff.
Wow.
And finally, going right back in time to 250 years ago.
250.
I'm really feeling
March 1768.
I just about remember this,
William Cookworthy of Plymouth was granted the patent to make porcelain, true porcelain for the first time.
Porcelain?
Porcelain. It goes back 250 years.
Wow, it's one of those things that we always think we've had forever,
you
I suppose.
Take it for granted, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought of it in time, did you, Patricia?
With plates and cups and...
No, I thought it was much older.
So 1768.
Yeah.
Wow, 1768. Amazing.
Wow.
It's sort of one of those things you think, you assume it probably came from China or something, don't you? But
China.
China. China.
See what I did there?
I see what you did there. Oh.
Just say a farewell thanks to Patricia H. Ash, and hopefully we'll see you again, speak to you again next month, Patricia. Take care.
You too. That sounds like a plan.
Bush and Symphony in Blue. Could never get enough of the old Kate.
She's lovely.
She is amazing.
Lovely.
And joining us now on the telephone is the equally lovely Robin Pierce.
Then,
hello,
is it
Robin.
Me that's not stupid?
Oh, I'm as lovely as Kate Bush.
You
Thank
are.
You guys.
Fantastic.
Hello,
Robin.
How are you?
I'm fine, but I'm going to have to call David Lovely before the show ends because he's getting most offended that I'm calling everybody else in.
That's all right.
David, you're lovely.
You're lovely. That's lovely.
Lovely, isn't it?
Lovely.
Speaking of the Welsh.
How are you, Robin, and how is Wales today?
Wales is very cold and very windy. I, however, remain warm and perky.
Lovely.
That sounds great. Excellent.
Fantastic.
And what will you be reviewing for us today?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I went to see a double bill, and the double bill was Black Panther and The Shape of Water. Now, being an out-and-out Marvel maniac, and have been for about 50 years, I would have put good money down that Black Panther would have blown me away more than The Shape of Water, and I would have lost every last penny.
Oh, wow.
Del Toro really stole the day for me with this one. I'd been curious about The Shape of Water, particularly what Del Toro would bring to the screen this time, because none of his films are ever exactly the same. I mean, they've got a visual poetry to them. He can tell a fairy story, he can tell a monster story, giant lizards, everything. But this time, he seems to have gone a way more sensitive. I'd kept away from all spoilers, aside from a vague notion that it was an unusual, you know, love story concerning a humanoid fish man.
Oh.
But I couldn't avoid that because Starburst magazine had me write an article to tie in about films with humanoid fish men.
Okay.
So, okay.
Which probably included Hellboy, I suppose.
It did include Hellboy.
Yes.
And there is kind of an allusion to Hellboy in it. There is and there isn't. I will explain.
Mm. Patrick Duffy, of course.
Yes, the man from Atlantis.
The man from Atlantis.
Yeah. That's well, harking back. Now we're really
you know
feeling
what?
Your age.
On a personal note, I actually have two webbed toes on each foot. I live near the sea. I can't swim.
That's hilarious.
Yes.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Next week of the Sci-Fi Weekender, I'll show you if you pay me.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, the setting is a secret research facility in 1962. Now, at the bottom of the food chain of this facility, unseen by all the scientists and researchers and security, are the cleaning crew. Sally Hawkins plays Elisa Esposito, and Octavia Spencer, who stole the show in last year's Hidden Figures, plays Zelda, her co-worker. Now, into the facility comes a top-secret research project sealed in a steel box before being transferred into a larger, open topped water-filled tank, and in that is an amphibian. Now, Elisa, is mute due to some scarring on her neck, which we are led to believe was caused during childhood, so she can't speak. She has this empathy with the amphibian, which is being tortured by an unscrupulous Secret Service guy.
Oh dear.
And they start building up a relationship.
Ah.
Now, the way that the amphibian was caught, we don't see, but there's a throwaway line from Strickland, the security guy, that goes, "I dragged that filthy thing out of the river muck in South America all the way here, and along the way, we didn't like each other much." So basically, what he's saying is, the creature from the Black Lagoon is the prequel to this film. This is basically what happened afterwards.
Okay.
No, interesting.
That's nice.
Originally was going to be a Creature from the Black Lagoon movie, wasn't it?
There was. It was going to be remade by John Carpenter in the early 80s before
wow.
he went to the thing,
oh, but,
wasn't it?
But Del Toro was lined up to make one, I think. And this is why he made Shape of Water instead when that fell through.
Mm.
Well, if you look at the creature, he owes an awful lot to the Gill Man from the Black Lagoon, except he's more colourful, but then Creature from the Black Lagoon is a black and white movie. But also, he owes a lot to Abe Sapien from Hellboy, which is not surprising, really, because Doug Jones played both roles.
There you go.
Right,
yes.
I see. Interesting.
But one thing that I have to note, not to put too much a spoiler. The military, of course, wants to vivisect the amphibians. Soviets are concerned that the Americans learn nothing. The ending is a bit on the nose.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go anywhere near that.
No.
But it's as perfect a film as Del Toro has delivered to date. It has a haunting musical score by Alexandre Desplat. And I heard it on Classic FM. And I knew I had to buy it as soon as I heard it. It's that good. It's got striking cinematography with that kind of lush colour technicolour palette that jumps off the screen. Like Hugo and Life of Pi did, it's that technicolour look that was widely used back in the early 60s, which is in tune with the era that the film is set.
Which actually I absolutely love. I've always loved that glorious, and it was glorious technicolour.
You know, when I watch a colour film, I like to see bright, vibrant colours rather than that dull, washed out look.
Me too, sepia colours, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, listen, I don't even like watching black and white anymore, so you know, I'm very lazy that way, as you know. Anyway, I think we're going to go on to a little bit of Blackmoor Nights and Spirit of the Sea. Just stay with us, Robin.
I will.
I took a walk
What rating would you give it out of 10?
I would give it a solid 9.
Wow, that is a good score.
I was absolutely fascinated. I've not seen the film, and I didn't even know anything about it, Robin, until your description there. I was just fascinated by the title, because in my mind, it is such a literary title.
It really is.
You know, it gets you, what is The Shape of Water? Because, of course, it's whatever shape it's in.
The title kind of elicits notions of the kind of poetry that's in the film.
Mm. Mm. Yes, absolutely. And it's no real surprise that we've decided to talk some more about Guillermo del Toro's work in this edition of The Stone Tapes. That poetry, it just comes through so strongly, I think.
Absolutely.
In so much of his work.
His best work, definitely.
To pick one at random, Pan's Labyrinth, which I'm assuming we've all seen.
Yeah.
Pan's
definitely.
Labyrinth, Robin, yeah? You must have seen
it. Yes, that's the most poetic of them all, I think.
It's an incredible film, isn't it? But it's incredible, it's poetic, but it's probably one of the most powerful films I've seen.
Very grueling at times.
Very grueling.
It's a very dark fairy tale as well, isn't it?
Yes.
The position with the Spanish Civil War.
Yes.
And the kind of the thin line between fantasy and reality, and what is real, and what she's using as for escapism.
Mm.
Absolutely, you never really know whether the whole thing is just a complete.
Yeah.
But what I like particularly about Pan's Labyrinth is people have said, "Oh, it's so brutal," and the argument is that but it has to be to kind of justify what happens to that character over the course of the film.
Mm.
But also, the fantasy element is very dark, as you said, George.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredibly dark. It's very horrific. But actually, even though it's probably the darkest fairy tale you'll ever see, it's not as horrific as what's actually happening in the Civil War.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
The point of it.
And that's the whole
juxtaposition.
Point, yes.
And I think you have to have darkness to have light. And I think that's the thing that Del Toro does really well in Pan's Labyrinth. You get that, you know, it's this fantastical story juxtaposed against that horror of the war, and the war looks more horrific because of it, and you know, I think that's really important contexture to the film.
Absolutely.
So what is one of your most favourite Del Toro films, George?
I think Pan's Labyrinth is probably the top, but after that, I love them all, and I think there's a language to his films that is consistent throughout.
Definitely.
But Crimson Peak's another highlight for me.
Oh,
and I know it had mixed reviews. I think people expected it to be a horror movie. I think they marketed it as a horror movie. Mm. Actually, it's not. It's a gothic romance.
It's a gothic romance.
Yeah.
What about you, Robin? What's your thoughts on that?
I would definitely agree with George on Crimson Peak. It is an underrated gem of a film.
It's a beautiful film. I mean,
we've
watched it two or three times now.
Again, we come back to the use of colour.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Those vibrant reds that you get in this film.
Yes. But it's beautifully shot. And I was watching the extras, I think, on the Blu-ray, and there's an interview with Del Toro, and he's explaining how in a classic traditional gothic romance or a gothic story, and you'll get this completely, Sam, the actual location is as much a character as the people
that
are populating it. And that house, I've forgotten what it's called, the house on the top of the hill with the red mud.
Well, they call it Crimson Peak.
Crimson Peak?
Yeah, that's the colloquial.
But that house with its snow coming through the roof and collapsing floors and the basement
amazing.
And the cranky old lift shaft. It's just got so much personality.
I mean,
it's
the only complaint I've got was the ending was so tragic.
Yes, the ending's very sad.
It really, every time I watch it, I keep hoping it's going to change.
But actually, that's the sort of thing that would happen in a Del Toro movie, isn't
Absolutely.
It? The ending would change.
I know. And the scene in Crimson Peak that gets me every time is where again, I can't remember the names of the characters, I'm afraid. But the new wife, when she goes to the house with the guy, and she's looking down the corridors, and then suddenly this kind of corpse wrenches itself up from the floor down this corridor and starts dragging itself down the corridor towards her. Oh, that is so scary.
It really is scary.
Absolutely terrifying. it's an incredible piece of work. I absolutely loved it. I mean, another one that I'm particularly fond of is Del Toro's very first one, Kronos.
I've never seen it.
You've never seen
it? Oh, the vampire film.
Kronos, the vampire film.
Yeah.
Yes.
As Robin says.
Is it related to the Hammer in any way?
It's nothing to do with anything. Like most of Del Toro's work, it's nothing to do with anything that you've ever seen before. The idea of Kronos is, and you know, please correct me if I get this slightly wrong, Robin, is it's an old guy who works as a clockmaker or a watchmaker or something,
That's
isn't
correct,
it?
Correct, yeah.
And he basically finds a kind of like a scarab thing that appears like a mechanical scarab thing. I can't remember where he gets
it. Yes, it's like a mechanical beetle kind of
thing. That's right, it's like
That's
a mechanical beetle that he starts to try and tinker with and repair. And this thing basically attaches itself above his heart on his body. Yeah, right. Your claws come out and it kind of grips onto him. But he finds he starts to get younger.
Oh, yeah, it grants eternal life to its host.
Yeah.
And
there's a kid involved, isn't there? And it's the kid, it's his grandson.
Yes.
And it's an incredible film that plays out. And as Robin says, it's a vampire film, but you'd never think it was actually
a
vampire
film. Does it have that kind of folklore-ish element?
You have the dying millionaire who wants the eternal life.
Yes.
And you've got his thug nephew, played, of course, by Ron Perlman.
Oh,
that's right.
Okay.
Yes, I
Ron Perlman was in it. Yes. Are we going to have a bit of a music break? And we're going to come back and continue to talk, are we? I think.
We are. You always live your life, never thinking of the future.
Hi, this is Mark Kermode.
Hi, I'm James Martin.
Hello, this is John Craven, and glad you're listening to Siren.
Siren FM.
Siren FM.
You're listening to Siren 107.3 FM.
I'm Dave Myers.
And I'm Cy King.
And we're the Hairy Bikers
on Siren FM.
Bing bong.
Great mix of music for Lincoln and beyond on Siren 107.3 FM. Siren FM.
And that was Owner of a Lonely Heart by Yes.
Fantastic.
A favourite of David's, I believe.
Absolutely.
And of George's.
And we felt as well that it was kind of quite redolent with Del Toro's films and the sorts of things that go on there. I wanted to bring in Del Toro's use of kids.
Oh,
because
yeah.
I think he is, it's almost exemplary. Mm-hmm. If you go back through these films, we mentioned there Kronos has got like a grandchild in. Mimic, which we're talking about a little bit, has got a kid in. Devil's Backbone, of course,
is
a convent with lots of orphan kids and stuff in. And I think every time he brings in a child, he really gets a great performance out of them. And the film just works for
it. There's even sequences in Pacific Rim with one of the characters flashing back to being a child, isn't there? With the
I don't remember that.
Yeah,
so
little
well.
Girl.
It's a long time.
Oh, the little girl.
Yeah. Exactly, and that's an important part of building that character as well.
But he does,
and of course, the child in The Strain.
And The Strain, of course, the kid in The Strain, and he does seem to have this affinity to. I mean, it's all very well casting kids, but they always say, don't they, never work with children and animals. But he always seems to get a tremendous performance out of
it. Maybe it's Children and Monsters, that's what you
Perhaps
have to do.
Perhaps it is. Perhaps that's
what
that you
works.
Need to do.
That sounds good to me, anyway.
and then we've got sort of peculiarities like Blade 2, which, I mean, I love the first Blade. And I get confused because there were three Blades, weren't there?
Yeah.
And is Blade 2 the one with Luke Goss? Is that number 10?
I should know this.
I can't remember. It's so long since.
Robin?
It might be.
We're not sure.
No, I don't think it was.
Was that number 3 then?
I think number 3
remember.
Was. Yeah.
So Blade 2 is a strange one. And then Hellboy, which we sort of touched on.
I adore Hellboy.
Yeah?
I love it.
I think they're brilliant films, both of them. And I love the comics.
Well, I was going to say, how close are they to the comics?
The comics seen through Del Toro's lens.
Right.
So the comics share that kind of folklorish, mythological weirdness.
But he didn't write the comics.
Mike Mignola wrote the comics. And but they share a common kind of language. But the films are very much Del Toro films using those characters. So I'm interested to see what the new Hellboy movie is going to be like, which has got nothing to do with Del Toro or Ron Perlman. Or Doug Jones, and I think you will see a very different take on it. People realise quite how Del Toro those films are, actually.
So, no Ron Perlman in a new Hellboy? Wow, that's just...
It's the guy from Stranger Things, the sheriff. He's playing Hellboy instead.
Oh, I see.
And it's Neil Marshall who's making it. The guy.
I wish he'd finished off his trilogy, though.
Yeah, I do as well.
Yeah.
Hellboy 2, it lent itself to a sequel because it was... left on a kind of a cliffhanger, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it was, definitely.
I remember that.
Selma Blair's character was pregnant, as I recall.
That was 2008, from my list here. That's
well, it's a shame that he didn't get to finish it, but the other thing that I think is a huge shame is he was at one point attached to The Hobbit. Oh. Now, imagine what Del Toro would have done with The Hobbit.
Yes.
How different would it have been from Peter Jackson's version?
Yeah, I know. I wonder if the studios would have let it be that different, though.
That's probably why it wasn't.
They wanted it to be just like more Lord of the Rings, please, kind of thing. But and Pacific Rim, we touched on as well. And again, for me, that's the one that stands out as very different. Because it's basically his big monster robot thing.
It is, but I think
knocking himself to pieces in the sea kind of
it's
thing.
It's not. It doesn't have. I suppose it doesn't have the folklorish stuff, but it's got the mythology in it. I think the mythology of the monsters and this other universe and the Cthulhu elements is obviously the kind of elder gods is a thing that permeates all of his stuff, like Hellboy. You know.
Yes.
And I think it's that idea of other realms, these monsters coming from other realms under the sea.
But again, did Del Toro originate Pacific Rim, or did he just...
No, he made it? He directed it and was involved in it, but yeah. It was Travis... I can't remember his surname.
Okay.
He created it.
So it's by someone. And did it come from a comic, or was it...
No, it was written as a screenplay.
It was original screenplay.
Excellent.
Yeah. I know, this is amazing.
Fund excuses for the lateness of the hour, but we accept your invitation and we'll bring you melting flour. For the May Day is the great day sung along the Australian rank, and those who ancient lines did lay will heed the song that calls them back. Pass the word.
Was Jethro Tull and his cup of wisdom. Yes. Good fun, that?
Fantastic. I love that. I find that very mythical kind of sound that sort of seems to go with it.
And now it's that time. Yes, it's that time for the lovely David J.
Howard. See what you did there.
Film
well.
Of the month.
Bless you. Oh, really, really? Oh, oh, oh.
I might get that much. Glass of wine when I go home now.
So, yes, the film of the month... and we've been talking Guillermo del Toro. So we're going to go back to 1997 and to a little film called Mimic. Music going on there. Oh, there it goes. I knew it was there somewhere. And this is the fantastic score by Marco Beltrami for this film. Absolutely love Mimic. 1997 film, co-written and directed by Guillermo del Toro, based on a short story by Donald A. Wolheim, and it stars Mira Savino, Jeremy Northam, Josh Brolin, Charles S. Dutton, Giancarlo Giannini. It's hard to say.
It's Giannini.
And
yeah.
F. Murray
yeah.
Abraham. And according to this, it also features Norman Reedus in his first film. Debut, so that's amazing.
Doug Jones in his first
and Doug Jones, yes,
I think that's
yes.
his first appearance
is
in
that his first
Del Toro movie.
Wow. So what's it about? It's a horror film. The basic idea is that there's an infection is killing kids in I think it's New York, and to count this infection they discover is being spread by cockroaches. So they think, well, how do we get rid of the cockroaches? So let's create a natural predator, or an unnatural predator, for the cockroaches. So they create this thing called a Judas bug, which releases a kind of a secretion, which when the cockroaches eat it, they all die. So it kills off all the cockroaches, stops the infection, the kids of New York are saved. The problem is the sewers are now full of Judas bugs, which have been bred to... develop into a predator for the thing which is overrunning everywhere, which is like humans. So we flash forward 3 years and people are disappearing off the streets and there's these literally man-sized bugs hunting humans in the streets.
There's a lovely moment when, well, it won't be so lovely to anyone who doesn't like horror, when a man is dragged down into one of the sewers, which was reminiscent of It, actually.
Yes, he doesn't quite fit. So it's a fantastic film. Again, there's a kid in it who's absolutely brilliant, playing a slightly autistic character, and they all end up in the underground trying to find the solution. Mira Savina's like the person that developed this bug, so she's like an entomologist, and so she knows how to kill them, and so they all kind of band together to try and get down there to kill them. Along the way, there's lots of darkness, rain, beautiful set pieces, gorgeous locations. There's a smashing sequence all set in a deserted abandoned underground train, which gets attacked by these creatures. I actually absolutely love Mimic. It's a great monster horror film.
What's the mimic element then?
Because these creatures mimic humans. They develop a mask that they can put up. So where they stand upright and with a mask on, they look like a human.
It's almost and butterfly-like,
and then the
actually,
mask comes away and it's this great big buzzing insect thing attack you.
And they're like giant flying ants, aren't they, really?
They're absolutely amazing. Yeah. Incredible film. It's one that isn't often spoken of when people talk about monster films and monster movies and great horror films. And I think that's a great shame. So that's Mimic, 1997. I give it a very firm sort of 9 out of 10. A very enjoyable film.
Is that
film.
The original version or the Del Toro version? Because he was unhappy with the film at first, wasn't he? And he's done a director's cut, which is significant.
I think either are good. I'm not sure which one we watched. I don't know which one we watched, but I would have said either
we'll
is probably
that.
Great.
So, as I understand it, the studio did the final cut for the theatrical release and took it off him. And it was 2 years later or something.
It happens a lot,
then
that, doesn't
he got
it?
To do his own version.
Yes. How interesting. So what do you think about that one, Robin?
I like it. It is most in-your-face horror movie. It's been relentingly dark. I have no problem with the bugs, but I do find Mira Sorvino as a scientist hard to swallow.
I just remembered as well, there's another scene in it where a couple of kids get slaughtered, which is quite shocking.
That's right.
You don't often expect to see kids being slaughtered, except in It, I suppose.
It just occurred to me that Giancarlo Giannini, the grandfather in this, was he the same guy that was the grandfather in Cronuts?
That I'm not sure. He might well have been.
I'm just wondering about that. Anyway, something to look up for to the future.
So I love him.
Looking it up right now, and he was not.
He was not.
He was not. Well, right, thank you.
So I think that's a fantastic look through the films of Del Toro. I mean, it's an incredible body of work already. And, you know, I can't wait to see Shape of Water.
I'm really looking forward to that now.
Me too.
And we haven't really talked about The Strain, the TV series.
Yeah, but I think we're running out of time.
And
so
Sam's going to stop me talking.
I am going to stop you talking
right now. No matter how lovely I am.
Absolutely. So thanks so much to Patricia H. Ash, Robin Pearce, David J. Howe.
Hello, thank you.
George Mann.
Thank you very much.
And of course, our producer, Alex Levchuk. Until next time, say goodbye.
Unless the giant bugs get us.
Yes. Bye.
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 Bye.